The following is a production of Vanderbilt's Owen Graduate School of Management. For more information about Owen, please visit owen.vanderbilt.edu.
Good morning. Thank you, Jim. That was very nice. And thank you all for coming out this morning. This is a very unique place. Nashville is my hometown. I remember sitting out there, but it wasn't somebody in a suit making a speech. And this is such a famous place. I think the network is just fantastic, and we're pleased to be a part of it. What I'd like to do this morning is just share just a little bit about DuPont. Promise no commercials. Number two, talk about what I call a bumpy road around climate change and focus on climate change, and hopefully solicit you to play a role in that if you're not already doing so. But then spend the bulk of our time with your questions. I'd love to dialogue with you and understand your perspectives. I think it could be very useful for us. So DuPont is a science company. We're 205 years old, and our first century, we were an explosives company. We helped open this country with creating roads and also the defense of the country. In our second century, we were a chemical company, providing the basic building blocks to build the infrastructure that was necessary here. In our third century, we are indeed a science company, and you may say, what is a science company? And that's a company that takes chemistry, biology, and physics and put them together in a special way. Our magic around that is called sustainable growth. Our mission is to increase shareholder value, societal value, while we decrease our environmental footprint, and Jim shared with you a few of the specifics of what we've been doing. We're about a $30 billion revenue company today, and as Jim noted, we've had a 72% reduction in our greenhouse gas emissions, while we had a 30% increase in volume, and we saved $3 billion in energy costs along the way. So you might ask, how does a company that has such a strong tradition, is very proud of what we've done in chemistry, what's the spark that makes you change and start thinking about things differently? And there are probably many sparks, but there is one instant that, at least in my mind, was the key catalyst for a company thinking differently about itself. It was 17 years ago in the month of November. It was a rainy day early in the morning, and a group from Greenpeace visited one of our plants in New Jersey, but they didn't use the front door. They scaled the fence, climbed the water tower, unfurled a big banner, DuPont number one polluter at the bottom, aimed at a major bridge so everybody would see it on their commute to work. They were great at scaling fences. They're great at cleaning water towers. Not really good planners, because the word polluter was so low, you couldn't see it. True story. So the calls came in, we know you won another award, would you please tell us what it is? And if you've had experience with Greenpeace, there's just a coincidence that the TV trucks arrived just about 5 minutes after them. And so our plant manager handled it to perfection. His concern, as all of our concern is about safety. And we were worried about getting the people down off the tower without them falling. And we said, we'll be glad to discuss their concerns. We're worried about their safety first. So the evening news in Philadelphia, which is the major news center for there, was actually quite good to us. The next morning, we were sitting around critiquing, first, security breach, because it's very serious to have people running on chemical plants. But then we were basically complimenting ourselves, in fact, kind of patting ourselves on the back. What a great job we did here, and how well it was covered. And then one lone person stuck their hand up and said, but you know they're right. And you could have heard a pin drop. What do you mean they're right? Well, we are the largest polluter. What do you mean we're the largest polluter? Well, we put out more stuff. Well, we're the largest company. Of course we put out more stuff. And that's where the aha happened. Yeah, of course, every bit of it's legal. Every bit of it's been permit. It's all approved. But do we have to do that? do we have to look at a game that says to grow as a company, we have to grow more volume and we have to put more out in the environment? And that's what made us start thinking totally differently about that and started our transformation toward the kind of goals I've talked about. We clearly have reduced our footprint, but we focused on things we can do for our customers and society in general. And I'll just give one example before I go to global warming. We have a plant here in Tennessee. It's in East Tennessee that takes corn and converts it into a material that is transformed into something we call Sorona. It's our brand name. And if you're looking for a new carpet for your home, and you might call this a sales pitch, but I don't have my order book, so you're safe. But naturally stain resistant. It's very soft to the touch compared to nylon. It takes up dye very well, so it doesn't require as much dye to actually do the product. And it's very cost competitive with products you have on the market today. We also use it extensively now in conversion of automobile parts because they're renewable. We have a major cooperation with Toyota. They were just in this week, and their first question was to make sure we had enough supply of Sorona. And you could even make it into apparel. The suit I'm wearing this morning is made from corn, about 50% from that plant in East Tennessee. So it's quite a phenomenal product. And what we're finding is we greatly reduce our environmental footprint, about 40% less than it would be if we used traditional petrochemical products. Enough about DuPont. I would describe the comments today as about a bumpy road. And the topic is climate change. And the thrust I will share with you is there will be a bumpy road till we get to a society that thinks about the climate differently. If we sit back and wait till we have all the answers, in my terminology, until the road is paved, we're going to wait too long and that opportunity will close for us. If we travel that bumpy road too fast, we could get very sick. So what we think is important is that we start traveling that bumpy road right now and move, and we think there are solutions to it. DuPont was very active in the Montreal Protocol, which dealt with the ozone layer and CFC production. We have seen examples of the countries of the world coming together to really find solutions. We think it could be done again. Let me describe three aspects of my bumpy road. The first one are rules of the road. The problem we have in this country now is we do not know what the ultimate environmental legislation will be. And so if a company gets out front and takes early action, you don't know if you're going to be neutral because of it, credited because of it, or penalized because of it. That is holding back many organizations from taking steps they should be taking today to get down the road. Seeing this and recognizing we need to come out as a company, we thought we could come out as just one company, but we recognized that would probably be just one voice and probably not make much of a difference. So we worked with a group of 9 other companies and 4 major NGOs over a 1-year period of time to create something called the U.S. Climate Action Partnership. Perhaps you've heard of it. And we put together a series of very specific recommendations and principles, including what so-called cap and trade, which we think is essential, and a set of proposals that put real teeth into environmental legislation we could have in this country. And then we went to Washington and proposed it to everybody that would listen to us. We think it's very important that those rules not have a lot of off-ramps on the road. Some people would propose that, well, if the economy gets in trouble, we'll back off. We think if you've got those kind of off-ramps, it will really slow down progress. And we're quite encouraged at what could happen if we move forward. Essential part of our recommendation this spring to Congress was that we not tell everybody how they must do it, what exact process you must have, but we must specify very clearly the result. We do a lot of work in DuPont and the international arena, and my colleagues from Japan would quickly say the way they will go about it will be very different than the way we might go about it or the way China might go about it or India or maybe the UK, but it's very important that we take action. You may have seen the number of states, cities, and even regions of the country that have started action already. We think those are very good initiatives. They are certainly stimulus, but the idea of having different climate change regulation in every state, given the fact climate change is a global problem, we don't think is the ultimate answer. What I would leave you with on this first point of the rules of the road, everywhere you can have an influence to encourage to get the rules set. Quite frankly, exactly what they turn out to be isn't as critical as getting them set so everybody understands, because I personally believe the creativity and drive in this country will make us leaders in the answer. Second area, if you look at the overall climate change issue, you quickly conclude it's all about energy. If we solve the energy problem, we can solve climate change. If we don't solve energy, there are not enough other things that can make a difference. So it's critical that we find solutions. And we're all kind of looking for that one answer that can replace petroleum products as we know them today. I don't think we will find that answer. So as we describe this road, we're talking about, in our terminology, multiple vehicles. And we don't think the debate about is this renewable fuel better than that renewable fuel or vice versa. The issue is how do we move them all forward? How do we use each one in the most effective place that we can? I would stress to you something that does not get the publicity that most things does, and that's conservation. MITI, the major arm of the Japanese government that studies industrial change, feels that 58% of the reduction in greenhouse gases between now and 2030 should come from conservation. That's a major step, a step we can all take in our lives today, and I know just by the fact you're here, I'm sure you're taking steps in doing that. Let me describe one process they've put in place in Japan because I like its simplicity, and it's something we could very easily do in this country. It's called the Front Runner Program. And very simply, they took 21 appliances, if you will, it's kind of a general term, such as a refrigerator or a microwave oven or a stove, and they went out and measured the energy efficiency of everything that was commercially available in Japan. And then they found the one that was the best. And they looked at the technology that was available, and they projected it out for 5 years, and they said, we think we can take the best one and make it 10, 15, 20% better. It varied by industry. And they set that as a goal. And they simply said, 5 years from now, unless you want some very heavy fines, everybody manufacturing a refrigerator must be at that level. They started this in 1999, so they've been through their first cycle. And what they found was an average of 42% improvement in efficiency without really driving the cost of the ultimate products up. What we find in the conservation area is there are just a number of these very simple things that we can do on a routine basis that will make a difference. We sponsored in DuPont a global effort, 55 people from I think 9 different countries and many different professions to look at how do you really make a building self-sufficient, how do you make it energy neutral. As a result of that conference, working with the World Business Council, the conclusion was you can make a building energy neutral, means you'd have solar or other forms of power coming in and tremendous insulation, and you'd get a payback in 7 years. We think that is quite a driving area. In addition, there are a number of steps you can take today in buildings that can make a difference, and we need the processes in place, again, the rules of the road to drive people in that direction. Let me talk a bit about biofuels. Ethanol is a fuel we're using in this country. It's generally made from corn. Brazil is essentially self-sufficient energy, and their sugar cane is their feedstock. We believe that biofuels is one of those vehicles we need to go down the road. But we think the current methods of just taking grain and turning it to ethanol have a lot of ability to be improved. So we've been working with the Department of Energy for the last 7 years on cellulose to ethanol. So basically this means we're taking the stalk, the leaves, the corn cob, and rather than just plowing it back in the field where it has some value, we're taking it and turning it to ethanol. Our first prototype plant's under construction in Iowa now. We've collected material from this year's crop. It should be operating next year. We do not have all the scientific problems solved, but it's quite encouraging if we can think about cellulose that's not effectively used today and we can turn it into fuel. I think that's part of the answer. The second piece is biobutanol, a program we have with BP, which is what I call the next generation fuel beyond ethanol. It's fundamentally more energy per unit volume, and it also is it can be mixed much more easily with the current gasoline systems. So if you think about vehicles on alternative fuels, we think cellulosic ethanol and biobutanol are two. Obviously, there's biodiesel. There are a number of other products that we think will be part of the answer. Solar. I can show you the calculations to say it doesn't make sense to buy photovoltaic right now, but I can also tell you my sales of materials in the photovoltaics are twice what they were this time last year. There's something about photovoltaic that's logical, makes sense to people, and it's really catching on. And so the good news is there are major research programs around the world of how do we take a photovoltaic cell, which is about 15% effective today, and what if we could just get it to 30% effective? Well, we're talking about changing the economics totally. So we clearly believe photovoltaic will be a big piece of the answer. And I could tick out more and more and more answers to the question. What I would encourage you in your work and where you're stimulating change is focus more on moving as all of them we can forward rather than debates about which one is best. So we've talked about rules of the road. We've talked about the fact as we travel this road, we need to have multiple vehicles. And we've talked about the fact there can't be too easy an off-ramp to just stop when it gets a little bit tough along the way. We think that'll be critical. The third step is the destination. As I was a student here in Nashville, the idea of taking my money and going to a theater and buying a ticket to watch Al Gore make a PowerPoint presentation was not very high on the list. Yet, I must yield to my fellow Tennessean, he deserved that Nobel Peace Prize. I was in Japan 7 months ago, meeting with a group of customers that I've known very well for a long time, and I saw a tremendous increase in the need for dealing with climate change issues. And I said, this is the country where Kyoto was held. Why all of a sudden are you so much more interested? Is it the price of oil? No, it's the Al Gore movie. And I found that all over the world. It's just uncanny what telling that story in a form that people could listen to it, hear it, and comprehend it has made. And so I think that is a major step forward. But there's one more Nobel Prize to be won, because what Al Gore did was tell us all the negative things that could happen if we don't deal with climate change, and it woke us up. What I believe we need as a society, a global society, is the positive side of this. Why will it be a great place to live in 2050 if we make the changes, as opposed to it must be a different form of life, a negative form of life? And that is the challenge. How do we paint, and I don't know if it's a movie or what the process is to communicate to 6.5 billion people the opportunity, but I think there can be a better solution. The Aichi World's Fair in Japan in 2005 was all around the environment. It was a tremendous example of what could be done if you wanted to, because it was energy self-sufficient. The whole thing had no exterior electrical feeds. They did it with solar or biofuel or something within the system. I was particularly intrigued by the Toyota Pavilion, because although they didn't call it this, in my view, they were premiering what the transportation vehicle will be of the future. So if you picture the debate today, it's between hybrids and biodiesel and SUVs and not SUVs. The vehicle they described was like a large chair, and you would sit in it, and it would be powered externally, and it would be directed, so you program in where you want to go, and it takes you there. The difference is it's one person per vehicle. You don't have the issue of transporting a lot of mass you don't need. Because it's controlled, and this technology is available today, you don't have to put all that steel around it because it's not going to run into anything because it's controlled where it can't possibly do that. And you're talking about a fundamentally different mode of transportation we know today. That sounds way out, but I believe it could be possible within a decade. We're seeing so many things that we could do that would be very easy. There's a major European city we've worked with, and they've looked at the fuel consumption inside the city limits, and they found that 60% of the fuel consumption is because people are driving around looking for a parking place. So wouldn't it be so simple that you just reserved a parking place before you came in? And that way you don't come to town, you don't have all the frustration if you can't find a parking place in the first place. A very simple step we could take today that would make a great deal of difference. So as I close on my little bumpy road story, yeah, clearly we've got to have the rules and we've got to get them fast. We hope it can be done in 2008, at least by 2009. We think this country has to lead. We can't demand India and China to lead if we don't lead ourselves. Second, it's going to take multiple vehicles to solve this problem. Third, we don't have to have a lower standard of living. In fact, we could have a higher standard of living if we'll all pull together and do it. And we look forward that solving this issue could actually be very positive. So that was what I wanted to share with you today. And I believe we have a lot of time available for questions. And I understand there are four microphones, two on the upper level and two here. And I'd love to have some dialogue with you. Who'd like to kick it off?
Can I go ahead? Oh, sorry. Go ahead. Mr. Holliday, I'd really like to thank you for coming today. And I'd really like to thank you for the leadership that DuPont has shown in combating climate change, getting US CAP off the ground. You guys have really done an amazing job. But I know that DuPont hasn't been moving quite as fast on some other environmental issues, like life cycle stewardship, especially in developing countries where some of the chemicals are exported, and cleaning up hazardous waste sites. And I want to see, is DuPont going to be able to bring the same type of vision and innovation and find the same type of, you know, cost savings to address these very serious environmental problems that the company still has as a legacy of previous activities?
Oh, thanks for your question. As a 200-year-old company, and we operate 200 major sites, what we think is very important is the technology now understanding chemicals has progressed very much. So let's just say a chemical was introduced 75 years ago, and it was tested and approved based on the best available technology then. That's not good enough today. So as new technology has come out, one of our principles that we adhere to carefully is to be sure that we apply that new technology and then we take into account whatever needs to be done for that product. In pesticides or crop protection chemicals is a big area for us, and we focus very heavily on going back and analyzing our products, phasing out the ones that aren't good today, and seeking ones that will, you know, be at a much lower use rate, maybe one-tenth what it's been before. We did that in herbicides. We have a new insecticide coming out this year. Opposite your question of environmental cleanup, we do focus very much on that. We're in the process of cleaning up a number of sites globally. We operate to exactly the same standard everywhere in the world. So even though the environmental regulations in India or China might be different, we're still going to operate to the highest standard, which is usually the U.S. standard, but in some cases it's others. And so we're absolutely committed that where we learn about something we have to do from the past, we'll clean that up, and we're actively doing it today. Thanks very much.
Hi, my name is Laurel Martin. I'm with the Ross School of Business at the University of Michigan. And I think it's admirable what DuPont has done, switching from largely petrochemical-based inputs to corn-based and other bio-based inputs. But as you alluded to when you were talking about corn-based ethanol, there are issues with corn in that it's part of the food supply and it's not the most ecologically sound crop. And I was just wondering if you could talk a little bit about what DuPont is doing to look towards the next more sustainable input.
So, about 22% of this year's crop of corn will be for ethanol, biofuels. If you do the comparison, in Nature magazine, first week in December 06, issue did a great comparison of all the different crops and the fuel value, and I think it's a very competitive thing, very objective analysis. And clearly, sugarcane is a much better crop for ethanol than corn, but I think it's very natural that countries will use what they have available. Sugarcane is not the best crop to grow here. We believe the starting of the process with ethanol and modifying the vehicles they can use is a great step in the right direction. We don't think that's long-term sustainable. And that's why we've been working with the DOE on this cellulose to ethanol. And our scientists tell me that if we can solve it with corn stover, the cobs and the stalks like I was talking about, we can probably solve it with a lot of other things. And we were very pleased that right after his State of the Union message this year, President Bush elected to visit us to talk to our scientists about this work. So, interesting story. We get to the first scientist we were going through on this tour. And we know President Bush on his ranch in Texas or farm, whatever it is, has switchgrass. So we had a little pile of switchgrass. And so he comes into the scientist and he says, "Is that switchgrass?" "Yes, Mr. President, that's switchgrass." And so he's talking about this, we're basically talking about corn stover. And he said, "Now tell me, how does this switchgrass compare to corn stover on energy into ethanol, and do you think you can do it?" Well, Bill's answer was, "Yes, we think we can do it. We get the corn stover, we think we can do the switchgrass. We think it's going to be very similar. And they're very similar fuel values, Mr. President." And you could see Mr. President just stood up real tall. "You know, my switchgrass is as good as that stuff." And I'm sure he wouldn't mind me telling this story. And then our scientist said, "Oh, Mr. President, not your switchgrass. You've got that lousy land down in Texas. I was talking about good land up in, you know, Illinois or something like that." Excuse me, I love that story, so I got off the track. But you know, we think we can solve this problem. We're not there yet. But if you just imagine, if we could use all forms of cellulose, it's going to be a piece of the answer. Go through the arithmetic. If you think biofuels are going to solve it, no way. That's why my multi-vehicle store, we have a lot of answers. And our butanol process that we're working on, we will feed it with cellulose. Now, our first testing will be with other crops just to get it moving. But if we can't move it to cellulose, it probably won't be sustainable. So I think your question's right. And we've got to do it. The good thing is a lot of people are working on that problem. And I think we're going to make a lot of progress on it.
Howdy. Quick comment and a question. One, the comment is for your future speeches. Al Gore doesn't use PowerPoint. He's on the Apple board. And the reason that relates to the question is, just as Microsoft doesn't make everybody's software, you're not the only large chemical company. My question is, are you working with your competitors on any of these initiatives?
Oh, you see, yes.
That in some industries. And there are some examples where you're co-opetition, as it were, on these particular issues and competing elsewhere.
Okay. Oh, and thanks for the correction. I'll...
And you're about the third speaker to make that mistake this week.
So okay. If that's my worst mistake, we're okay. All right. is we wanted to take the next generation of biofuel. And if you did a Google search on biobutanol before we made our announcement, you got 7 hits. Today you get many thousands of hits on biobutanol. We concluded to do it by ourselves, not being an energy company, didn't make a lot of sense. So we went to every major energy company and said, "We got this idea. We might be crazy, but we think we can turn this waste product into a fuel that will work." And BP is the only one that took us up on it. So we were very pleased they did that. Some of the others kind of called back and said, we said no a little bit too quick. But clearly partnering with BP. In the plant science area, there's extensive cooperation. We have major cooperation with Syngenta, major European company in the field. And so what I'm seeing is many more cooperations. There are antitrust issues you have to pay attention to, make sure you don't step over the line there. But I find companies, because of the need for speed, are much quicker to cooperate. Good suggestion.
Hi. I'm Paul Herman from Hip Investor. I think you do a great Bush impression. I'd be interested in learning more about the management systems that you have in place at DuPont, and also the variety of measures, not only around the environment, but around the impacts on health of your customers and employees and your suppliers, as well as the impacts on wealth of your company, shareholder value, and how the diversity of employees that you have contribute to that innovation. So just quickly, Shell Oil has 20% of its performance bonus attached to social and environmental measures. And your good friend, Mr. Immelt at General Electric, has given a greenhouse gas target to its heads of the business units that they have to hit in addition to shareholder value. And Interface, which you're probably familiar with, is seeking to be restorative to the environment by 2021 after it becomes sustainable in 2020. So if you could talk about how the performance measures, the performance reviews, the positive management systems work within DuPont, and how all of those drive positive shareholder value, which is the core self-interest of corporations.
Well, that's a great question, and it's not a quick answer, but if the audience is okay, let me take a little more time to answer it, because I think it's a very important question. So let's start with the external view. So we believe biology will be a big part of the answer. So we have an external advisory board that's been in place for 9 years. And with people from India, China, Mexico, scientists, and even have a priest on the external advisory board, to be sure we're bringing a full perspective to everything we do around biotechnology. Not only do they make a joint report and they have full access to everything they're doing, they have, and we would sponsor this, they can make an individual report. We'll post it on our website with anything they want to say about what we're doing that might not have come out in the joint report as it was put together. When you do that, you attract some great people that want to be a part of it. And so we think that is one aspect, because we think we need the external piece. On the health side, we have a medical advisory board with 8 prominent physicians. They're in both the academic world and the practicing world. Dr. Green, is drgreen.com, is great in the pediatrician area, just to give you one example of the people on that board. And they equally have full access to everything we're doing around employee safety and product safety, and are advising us on every step we're taking. And those are spirited discussions. I meet with both those groups every time they're in. So I think the first step is having you're right up to the mirror with an external view, and those are the two units we use, and we think they're very effective, and encourage you to talk to any of them about how well we listen to them and pay attention to what we're doing. Now, second, what we have is sustainability reviews inside, where we don't look at just what happens on our plant or just what happens with our suppliers. We're always mapping the entire value chain. So if you look at our goals and objectives on our website, if we just reduce here, but it creates more downstream, we really haven't accomplished anything. So everything's around the entire value chain. So a lot of our research is actually aimed downstream. As we've talked about our research commitment for 2015, we're going to double our research around the environment. It's about a third of our total budget today. We'll double it. The total budget will probably go up too, but we're going to double that amount. But so much of it is downstream products that we're making, because we can find that can make a bigger difference than just our piece of the equation. 10% of our bonus, or whatever you call it, is judgmental around factors like this. And we go into every unit, and we make that judgment by the unit. An individual's bonus can be eliminated or it can be doubled based on what they do around environment, safety, and our core values in general. So it's a very active part of what we're doing, and what we find is many companies benchmark that. It's been in place for some time. And I think GE has done a great job. I think Jeff and them have really moved. I think they've got a lot of products, and I commend what they're doing. What we have found, though, is if we say everybody's got to cut by 10%, we don't get as much result as if we, what we do is say we want to fund the best projects. So we have a separate process outside our normal budgeting where if you've got a great project, and it might be a little risky, it might not be a sure bet, but it can maybe make a 50% environmental impact, you can come to that and get special funding. And that's how we've made the 72% reduction in greenhouse gases. Not by everybody trying to cut a little bit. It's by making sure we're funding the big projects that have the big leverage. So that's not everything we're doing, but I hope that gives you a sense of that. It's very important. The other thing is the reviews of each business that take place every year. We have our Chief Sustainability Officer, Linda Fisher, sits with every unit and maps it through and challenges them to a different way of thinking. In fact, the Sirona product that I was talking about earlier, some of those applications came out of one of those reviews. So I think it's really, really good. So thanks for the question.
Morning, Mr. Holliday. My name is Matt Sharm with the Ross School of Business at the University of Michigan. I will mention I was one of the people that was out on the strip late last night, but I still came in, so I'm excited
to be here.
Well,
thank you very much.
Sure.
Can you ask a coherent question, though?
Yeah, I'll try my best. this is sort of a lofty question, but being from the manufacturing industry before I came into business school, I do realize that trying to clean up and trying to become a zero-impact company is very, very difficult. So my question is, do you believe it's possible for a company like DuPont, with the type of business that you're in, to become entirely zero impact on the environment? And that's just not for the future, but also for the past cleanup issues and the present. And on top of that, I'd be interested to hear some of the setbacks you've had as you try to become more environmentally friendly, some of the failures you've had with attempting to do that.
The United Nations University has an award. It's I forget the exact, but it's a zero impact award. And they looked around the first year they were going to give it and said, what companies have set as a goal zero impact on the environment? They could only find one. It was us, so we won the award. We know zero impact is a lofty goal. We also know our goal of zero injuries to our people is a lofty goal. What we have found, though, aiming for that, you move so much faster. And so we generally try to stay away from a debate, will you ever actually get to zero? Well, it's going to probably take a while. We accept that. But we think by aiming for that and setting that standard, and one release is not okay. Because what happens if you say, okay, if I had two releases last year, I'm going to have one release this year, that's a 50% improvement. No, you got to aim for zero. And so what we find is our rate of improvement so much faster moving for zero. So as opposed to trying to analytically say we can actually do it, no, we can't. But clearly, I think that's the direction. Let me tell you kind of a personal story. Asbestos. I think we all know now what asbestos can do to you. And I was the senior leadership of a plant, it's been decades ago. And nobody knew what asbestos would do to you then, but we were starting to understand. And we knew that people that had been doing insulation around pipes, and so we looked back at the population of our people, and we saw people that had been, you know, pipe insulators were having health problems. So that was giving us a clue as to where to look. But we saw this one population of people that we couldn't understand why in the world we were seeing health indications there. And as we looked, we found they were floor sweepers. And at that point in time, they were just throwing asbestos down to collect the dust, a practice nobody knew was a problem. And you talk about a cold chill, because then you all of a sudden saw that and realized where it might be repeated. And I think that's just what we have to learn from. But yeah, indeed, that one was an impact on me. That, oh my gosh, how could that have happened, and how do we take care of it? We no longer had asbestos on the premises, of course. But we will learn things about chemicals, and we can't be concerned to do that. We have got to go through the testing. The REACH process in Europe, which if you don't follow the industry, it might not be clear, but But the European Commission has started to requalify every Kempo. Well, that's oversimplification, but that's what they're doing. We think that is the right thing to do. We can debate about exactly how, what process, but it's the right thing to do. As I said earlier, you got to use the latest technology, and we just believe the globe ought to standardize on it. So there's a lot this industry can learn, but there's a lot of value this industry brings too. And so we got to get the balance right. Great question.
Morning, Mr. Holliday. My name is Rick Ribe. I'm from the Marshall School of Business at the University of Southern California. I have a question that was prompted by one of your comments about the corn fiber, but I think applies to a lot of the technologies we're dealing with. And that is, you had mentioned that you're able to make a lot of things out of corn fiber now that you used to plow under into the feedstock and had some fertilizing qualities. And my question with this and other technologies is, how much of your work and your research is done upstream to determine what added cost there might be to using what were once simple staples for other processes that you're now using for what may become very, very marketable and very expensive and popular uses downstream?
Great question. And that's the first, we have stage gates that projects go through before we implement them. And the first stage gate is a full life cycle analysis. And so what we see is, even if the value chain, the marketplace is not working perfectly, so it's not rewarding for that yet, we take that into account. And if we see this is not going to be a sustainable a process, we won't go down that route. And so I think that's very critical. We think ultimately the marketplace, we think it's very critical in environmental change, let the marketplace work. But where the market can't properly take care of the environment, that's where legislation has to come in. But great question. We agree totally with the thrust of what you have. That's what we act every day. And we think it pays off for shareholders, too, in what we're doing.
Hi. My name is Lewis Perwin. I'm from the Keenan Flagler Business School at University of North Carolina. I have sort of a more general question. Can you speak to, obviously, a lot of the thrust of business involvement in sustainability as well, legislative action, although with the current administration that has been less of an impact, is towards sustainability with Kyoto and a lot of those other thrusts. Could you speak to actually large corporations like yours using sustainability, sustainable practices to actually gain competitive advantages in the domestic marketplace and vis-a-vis international competitors?
So let me just give a piece of background. In climate change, we think it is absolutely a requirement to have some form of legislation to drive it. Because it's not like other forms of environmental impact, because I can't see the dirty water, I can't see the soot in the air. So there's going to have to be some additional help to make that work. It will not be just companies doing the right thing on climate change. A number will, and our projects we've done, we have paid off very well. As you start thinking about competitive advantage, you must look at the entire value chain. You must do extensive studies of what consumers want and what your customers want and take that into a case, and then design the products that will make a difference. So is the Sirona product I mentioned earlier, just to stay on that theme, it wasn't obvious that was going to pay off. There are a lot of people told us we were crazy. People are not going to do that. But we understood the value chain well enough. We thought we understood the drivers. And that's a product today that we could sell 30% more next year if we had the capacity. So I think it's kind of understanding that overall piece. We're a for-profit company, and we have shareholders that we have to serve. And so if we don't serve those shareholders, we won't be here. So we've got to keep that in balance in what we're doing, and that's the step. It is a very lofty question. I'm trying to think of what would be a more appropriate answer. I think being able to look at what I call the hot spots in the chain, hot spots not just from an environmental standpoint, but hot spots in a real value loss standpoint, and then really concentrating our scientific effort there. Like the question earlier, working with a partnership or a consortium to go in has made a big difference. And this corn biorefinery we're doing, we have a consortium we put together. So the collection of the corn stover from the field, John Deere's got the lead in that. and they're taking it. So I think it's very important you put the balance together.
Morning, Mr. Holliday. Steve Wilfong from St. Joseph's University's Halb School of Business. And I think it is a good morning because I think it's getting close to 9:45 and our protester friends outside haven't climbed the fences yet. You had mentioned that DuPont is a major proponent of cap and trade legislation for emission reduction. And just if you wanted to talk a little bit more about cap and trade and also the two major criticisms that I think this type of legislation gets. Number one is that many of the larger corporations that have more resources than some of the smaller corporations could potentially benefit from being able to purchase that extra cap space to be able to continue higher levels of emission versus some of the smaller companies. And secondly, that emission reduction legislation potentially can benefit, or I'm sorry, could potentially could penalize some companies that have already been at the forefront and made steps towards already lowering their emissions. So I wonder what you would say about some of that criticism.
So if you went to those that are against cap and trade, let me give you a few more criticisms that they would have. It's clearly that, can you manage it? Is there a way to really keep up with the system so you really know what you're doing? Very legitimate question. And there's some models that have been developed, but they have to be proven, they have to be tested. Second, will, if we give certain countries a break, will that basically mean that companies will buy their credits and shut down facilities in Germany, in Japan, in the U.S., and just buy credits and all the jobs flow to India, China, or wherever it might be? So those are real issues. A tax system is an alternative. Either you could tax it, just make it more expensive. We think that could work too, but if you've studied the tax code, you know it's a little complicated. And so we get a little worried that if it's just a tax, maybe tax loopholes will come into play, especially international taxes, and it may not be effective. So we really come out to cap and trade, and believe me, this was a debate we had well into the night, is the best available mechanism. Europe has used a cap and trade to implement Kyoto. We think it could be improved, but if you point to it and say there were flaws, absolutely there are flaws. But the reason I personally like it is that what we used inside DuPont to make a 72% reduction. So the first year we decided to do something about greenhouse gas, it went out and said, everybody cut 5%. You know what happened? We came back the next year and we didn't cut anything at all because everybody had a really good reason not to cut 5%. So next year we said a little bit louder, cut 5%, we're really serious. Next, nothing was cut. So we got this thing wrong. Let's make it 10%, maybe they'll cut 5. Well, you can kind of guess the story. Nothing was cut. So we said, okay, let's take this different approach. What we want is the best projects. We'll fund them over and above your budget. Bring them to us. Oh, and by the way, we give personal awards if you come up with those projects. Wow, the projects came in. And the willingness to take a risk, the willingness to do something, and all of a sudden ideas we never dreamed were possible started to come out. So I think if we could get the cap and trade right as a country, it makes sense. In Japan, they won't do cap and trade. They'll do voluntary. And we sit around here and say that'll never work. Voluntary in Japan doesn't mean the same as voluntary here. It'll work there, in my judgment. So we can't tell the world how to do it, but our guess is the cap and trade. And so what we say is, let's get started on it. And we've done it in CO2. We've done it in some areas in the past. It's not an easy task. And I don't mean to get too philosophical with you, but we're talking about this generation making changes for a generation we might never meet. That's a tough thing to get 6.5 billion people to do. Us don't kid ourselves about how tough this task is, but from everything we've seen around the science, we better get on with it.
My name is Christoph Heinzer from the Eller College at the University of Arizona. His comment about the protesters, I figured it was only fair to give you a chance to sort of counter some of the claims they make in the literature they've been handing out. One of the things was the HCFC not reported in your 72% greenhouse gas. They said that some of your numbers were unclear on that. And then the PFOA and some of the groundwater leakage and the fact that you continue to sell some of these products. I figured it was only fair to give you a chance to address some of these issues.
I appreciate you very much. You give me a chance. That's great. No, seriously. So
So my friends outside I haven't seen, but it's unique. This is the third, this is the steelworker thing. Is that what you're talking about?
Yeah.
Yeah. So the steelworkers actually have a headquarters here. Not their main headquarters, or sub-headquarters or something. And this is the third public talk I've given in Nashville since they've had their national organizing campaign against us. The first two times they missed it. So they're getting better. They understand we're here. So what's behind that? And you can talk to them and they can speak for themselves. But they do have a national organizing campaign trying to organize our sites. And they haven't been very successful at that. And so this is part of the campaign. But I defend their right to make any claims they want. So let me talk about a couple of them that are on there. PFOA is a surfactant used in the manufacturing of fluoropolymers. Fluoropolymers are used for the electrical insulation in this building, I hope. They're used in aircraft. They're used in many different applications. They're a pretty essential product to our society. And the PFOA is not a part of the product. Think about it like the soap when you're washing your dishes. It's the soap that washes off. It doesn't become a part of the product. But hence the issue is it does go into the water. It does go into the air. And it is a biopersistent. So if it is in your blood, it will stay there for a long time. We've found absolutely no health effects of that, but that's a concern. We've started studying it. We've studied for 40 years. We really increased our focus in the last 10 years, and we have been able to make a 96% reduction in emissions of that product. And we're below any kind of health level that's required anywhere. Yet we understand it's an emotional issue, it's a concern, so we've made the commitment that by 2015 we won't buy, make, or sell PFOA. And if we can get out before 2015, we will, but we think these products are critical. But if we can't find the solutions to every problem by 2015, we'll get out anyway, because that gives our customers long enough time to convert to something else to insulate their wires or what they want to do. So I'm quite proud of our, how we've handled that product. But it is an emotional product, and we've had some lawsuits in places. And so it's something, but our process is no different than anybody else's. What was another one you had? I forgot.
The individual plants, not mentioning their HCFC as part of the greenhouse gas and some of the individual plant reporting versus your voluntary reporting.
Yeah, there was, as we were talking with the other question around, how to do cap and trade, one of the biggest issues is proper reporting and how do you measure it. And I forget the exact name, but there is a gas emission kind of checkboard. They go through and they look at what companies' emissions reporting, and they say, who is the gold star winners that do the most complete job? We're one of them. So we've seen no indication whatsoever that we have. And when you've cut 72%, why would you cheat about it? I mean, 68 would be just good enough. So it's actually, I don't have any question that we're reporting it right. Thanks for asking, though. We appreciate it.
Morning. Thank you for coming. Sally Harrison, Duke's Fuqua School of Business. You've made some very bold goals for 2015. And I think the rules of what's good and bad in the environment are always changing. And when I was an intern with DuPont this summer, we had some training on green marketing versus greenwashing. And I was wondering what you're doing to educate your employees across the globe, globally, at varying levels, about the decisions they're making and the environmental impacts that they're having?
Great question. Since you were there this summer, I think it was September we put this in, but we now have an account for every employee where they can calculate themselves their greenhouse gas impact and what it would take to be neutral for them. And the individual steps they can take. In addition, we haven't put this in place yet, but it's our next step. Or say, then if you wanted to donate some money to plant some trees, so if you wanted to make yourself greenhouse neutral, you could. So we think a big, big piece of it is education and people understanding what you can do. And so we've done that with each individual employee. What we find is our employees are kind of excited about what we do. I think maybe you sense that. The leadership role we're taking in these areas. And we have as you recall from being there, a daily newspaper, electronic, where we talk about at least one example that's been done somewhere in the company.
And so it's just something about every day seeing another example of what's happened that we hope will stimulate more ideas from people. That's great.
Thank you. Jennifer Anastasoff, Building Blocks International. It's easy, and I'm just following up on the question just now, it's easy to listen to you and go, okay, great, you know, you're a charismatic guy. I'm sure when you say something, everyone's listening.
I'm not so sure about the last, but that's
How do you engage employees even more? You just mentioned education, but in terms of action on the ground in local communities, how are you engaging employees so that they truly feel the difference that they can make or should make?
We have for now 14 years had our sustainability awards, where we look at the individual projects across the company. We have another outside board that comes in and evaluates those projects and picks the 12 best winners. One of the things we do after the team wins, rather than compensating them directly, we let them pick any type of agency they want to that's focused on the environment, and the company makes a donation to the agency. Part of us making a donation is the employees need to spend some of their volunteer time there. So we focus very much on encouraging, rewarding, recognizing people taking their volunteer time. And we think by our major awards program for sustainability, the money going to the community, not to the individuals, we think sets that example. I'm just generally pleased with, I go into communities, I see our employees naturally want to do that. Generally, our employees stay with us for a long period of time, not everybody. We have an intern over here, we got to re-recruit. But other than that, yeah, but so I think that's it's very important, because we look at being a part of a community for some extended period of time. I was in China on Monday, and we're working to site a new titanium dioxide plant in China. And I was meeting with the governor of a province, and the province there had 93 million people in it, so a good-sized group. And as I came across the bridge going into this town, I saw this dilapidated plant that had been obviously shut down. And the government official that was riding with me said, you ought to know what that plant is. That was a TiO2 or titanium dioxide plant. And the mayor of the city shut that down because of its environmental footprint. And second thing you ought to know is the mayor of that city was shut down, is now the governor you're getting ready to go see. So you got your work cut out for you today. So, but the bottom line is we were able to explain our process and how it's so much more environmentally friendly, and I think we'll get the siting of that plant. But it's very much you have got to engage the local community. We do have community action teams at every site that get feedback from the community on what's going on. Thank you.
I'm Alan Cordova, Columbia Business School, and I think for a lot of us, the challenge is not necessarily convincing the people in this room that these issues are a problem, but it's the people outside the room. And you know, as the head of a public company, you must go to shareholders who are not looking necessarily at DuPont in 2050, but DuPont next year, and looking at the short-term value. And they might make the argument that all these projects and all these incentives are destroying their value. They're taking money out of their pockets and putting it towards these projects. What do you say to them? Take us, maybe if you can take us through how you talk about, you know, creating value at the company in the short term, to how you articulate that to the street.
So first, when you find those shareholders are looking for this year, would you please send them our way? Because it's the next week ones that are kind of giving us the biggest trouble. We had, you know, as a public company, a shareholder can put a resolution on our annual ballot, our annual proxy. It only takes one shareholder or one share of stock to do it. Last year, we had a resolution asking the shareholders to tell us we had to stop doing this. You know, very direct, directly with your question. And we look forward to answering that, because the steps we're taking are right for shareholders too, because they are reducing cost, they are creating products that are highly desired, and quite frankly, we think we've been vindicated with the process we started some time ago, because there has been a shift. There has been a shift that you just would not believe around just this Sirona product we're talking about, but I could talk about many more, about how people are starting to understand the impact and are asked for that. If you look at our website, we have a site just talking about renewable materials, because if you go with a Toyota,
even though we can't make a part totally renewable, if we can make it 50%, 60% renewable, they're looking at the renewability of the entire car. So those are steps in the right direction. So we're seeing tremendous demand for these products. And I think that issue is starting to shift away, and $95 oil kind of reinforces that every day. So it's a great question. We deal with it, but we're not just doing things, giving away the shareholders' money, just giving away. We're in projects that we think will make a difference.
Hello, Mr. Holliday. My name is David Korn. I am an economics major at the University of Michigan, and I have a professor who has just done who's an agroecologist at Michigan, has just done a study showing that in developing countries that have not been touched by conventional agriculture, there's actually organic farming has yields 4 times higher than conventional methods versus the United States. And for the extra health inputs from chemical fertilizers and pesticides, with cancer rates in children increasing in California and rates of infertility increasing, and also with the organic movement in the United States increasing, will DuPont make any changes in their fertilizers or their agricultural inputs for farmers, maybe providing for organic inputs?
Yes. Now let me break into jail, okay? So we genetically enhance plants. I am sure there are people in the room that feel that's not a very good idea. And there might be some people in the room that are neutral, and there might be one person besides me who thinks it is a good idea. If you look at agricultural overall, then let me ask you a question. In the last 10 years, 12% increase in the population of the world. I won't get this exactly right, but they're close. 35% increase in corn production, 55% increase in soybean production. And really, those are going in to feed chickens and hogs, because those people with higher standard of living want to eat, get their protein processed through an animal for some reason. There's only been a 2% increase in arable land. And we don't see how you can get much more than a 2% per year without doing things that are devastating to rainforests and so forth. So we have got to get more productivity off our land. There's just no choice. There's got to be more productivity. And as we talked earlier, you can't use it all for fuel. You're going to have to get fuels another way, and I think we'll get that. We think biotechnology, which is basically making the plant stronger in a controlled environment, is the right way to go. Then you don't need the chemical in the first place. Our new nitrogen-enhanced plants, they're not commercial, but they're in the pipeline. You wouldn't need the fertilizer. You wouldn't need as much fertilizer. So we think it's absolutely essential for a sustainable world that we move in exactly the direction you said. We have a new insecticide coming out there that is 1/10 the use rate as previous insecticides. So it's important that we keep increasing the productivity of agriculture, but we have to do it in a different way. Organic is great. I'm not sure organic will be enough to get there. But if the consumer wants organic, we ought to give them organic. And this is going to sound like a commercial. I don't mean it to be. But just stop and think about it for a minute. Everybody's already had their breakfast. But the idea of processing the soybean through an animal to get your protein when there's great protein already in the soybean is probably not the most practical. But to get people to eat the soybean directly, it's got to taste good, it's got to have texture, and so we are the largest direct ingredient supplier of a soy protein. So in your power bars and in different products, it's Soleil is our product that we have there. We're a producer and actually marketer of soy milk. And if I think soy milk is a great way to get your protein rather than other ways. So I think some of it might be on educating people that you can go upscale to get your protein directly from the plant, not having to go through an animal.
Skylar from Hip Investor. I had a question building on the shareholder value. Do you have specific goals linked to your 2015 goals around profits and shareholder value? And how are you measuring profit and shareholder value that's coming directly from those goals outside of just general work you're doing?
So if you look at our 2015, so let me back up on goals a minute. We find it's useful to have goals about 7 to 10 years out
that we can set much greater goals than we ever could in other techniques. So this is our third set of long-term goals. We just announced them last year for 2015. The goals are into two groups. What we're doing to reduce our environmental footprint, less impact on what we're doing, less emissions from our plants, moving toward the goal of zero. And the next set is what we're doing for our customers. One of our goals is we've committed to have the most fuel-efficient vehicles in every country where we do business. So now we have our fleet of automobiles in the U.S. are up to 13% hybrids. We're on our way to 100%, assuming that stays the most fuel-efficient technique that we can have. We've committed to turning out more products for people's safety. We've committed to 1,000 new products for people's safety by 2015. Both those goals, both the fuel efficiency goal, are good return for our shareholders, lower cost. And the 1,000 new products, we're going to get good value out of those new products for safety. So in accomplishing the goals, we pick the ones where we believe we have the science that can make a difference in what's going on.
Do you have specific measures linked to those where you're saying we're going to save this much money or we're going to increase it by X percent by doing this?
Project by project. Okay. Every project has to meet our minimum return rates, either in terms of return on investment or overall cash flow, net present value in every individual project. And we have goals for the company overall. There are so many other factors that are impacting what the company does. You can't just add up all the individual environmental projects and get to the answer of the company. But we have to do both.
Thanks.
Mr. Holliday, thank you for taking our questions. Realistically, I'm a little bit of a cynic. I don't think in the coming 2 years we're going to see government legislation coming in and telling us what's going to need to be done, whether it's cap and trade. What is DuPont going to be doing on the worst case, or if nothing happens in the next 2 years? What do you have planned in a proactive way?
I was testifying before the Senate on this U.S. cap. And this senator said, you know, if you had to comply with Kyoto, wouldn't that kill your company? I said, Senator, with all due respect, we're a major factor in 70 countries. And we comply with Kyoto in all but two of those countries. And this is one of them we're in. So, you know, being a global company with 60% of our sales outside the U.S., we're living with the current legislation that's being enacted in every country right now. And quite frankly, we're learning from that. Because the U.K. and Japan were ahead in Kyoto, we developed a whole series of insulation products for those markets that weren't desired here, but are desired here now. So it's actually paying off for us. We're going to stay, if there's not legislation in this country, there will be legislation in other places. We're going to keep up with it, try to stay ahead of it. I'm more optimistic than you. Now, I say 2008, that might be a little optimistic. 2009, maybe give me 2010. But what I see is a movement in this country that is really, really people are starting to understand. And I think if we can take reasonable first steps, it can make a difference. Thank you.
Good morning, Mr. Holliday. I'm Michelle Miller from the Presidio School of Management in San Francisco. Moving from explosives to chemicals to science, how are you moving from a risk analysis model towards precautionary principles, and how are you mixing those in that movement? And also at the same time, if you could maybe address some of your technologies or policies or philosophies with regard to biomimicry, living machines, things like that.
I just couldn't hear the last couple, the examples you gave.
Biomimicry, John Todd's living machines as ways to address pollution or alternative agriculture's methodologies and so on.
Precautionary principle is
first, you can ask six people and get about seven definitions of what it means. But as scientists, it concerns us to arbitrarily say we will not adopt a technology because we cannot absolutely approve everything about it. We think with the other strains on the world, that's not a good balance for the environment. And this may sound a little corny, but we see the human being as kind of a part of nature, not something out here that's the controller of everything. And that more as we see ourselves a part of this total system rather than the controller of it, there's a different mindset that goes on. And so that's kind of put that in perspective. What we believe is we need very clean, very objective, very science-based processes that are peer-reviewed for technology to be introduced. And that's what we do ourselves. We think it's critical everybody do that. We think it's important that we don't have people going off golf on their own way. As opposed to some specific proposals, what we find is looking at leading-edge people that say, you ought to try this, we generally learn something from that. And so I was in Washington, and we were talking about how quickly we can get to cellulosic fuel. And my judgment was about 4 years. Well, there was somebody that said 10 years. There's somebody that said 6 months. Well, my first reaction was a six-month person was wrong, but believe me, I went and talked to them after the meeting. I want to make sure they didn't know something we didn't do. So I think whether it be a new concept or a new technology, we don't discount anything. We look at it and try to learn from it.
Can I ask a question?
Oh, yeah. Oh, thank you. I'm sorry.
Does this work?
Yeah. It is now.
Good. Greg Christian. I'm a chef from Chicago and a business owner. Thanks for giving us your time today.
Oh, great.
Over the last 25 years that I've been working with food, what I've noticed is more and more technical farming and more technical food. And then I look out into America and I see sicker and sicker children, more obese adults. I see more depressed people than ever before, more kids on medicine than ever before. Part of the way we farm is the local food systems are breaking down. And to me, it seems like there's a relationship to our health and well-being and mindfulness and our lack of, or our disappearing local food systems and the technical food that we now eat. I'm a food guy, so that's all I know. There probably are other reasons too, but the fact is we're depressed and sick. And the doctors are able to keep us alive longer, so the argument is normally, we're living longer than anyone else. So we're in the depression and sickness is just part of the deal. But I just question that, and I'm wondering if you think that there's a relationship between the loss of local food systems and technical food to how we are health and well-being-wise in this country.
Great question. Let me comment on the pieces where I've got some knowledge and not try to guess at some things. But we have a concern about the quality of the overall food supply and the testing methods that are going on. We have a DNA biotech-based process for testing food for quality for E. coli, for example. If you walk into a poultry processing plant today, you still see people looking at a chicken to see if there's any E. coli there. My guess is they're not going to see it. So what we need is much more scientific-based tests that are becoming available and are coming faster and they're becoming practical. So I think that's the case. Agree with you totally that all we can do to keep food supply local so we're not dealing with the long transports, we're much better off. Because every time you transport it, you start to run the risk of something not being handled right. So all we can do to develop local food supply, where that's practical, we should do that. With more and more people in the city, sometimes it's not totally practical, but we should. Again, I think education around the food supply and what we're doing around advertising and the messages we're sending to people that are developing the habits are very critical in the examples we set. So I think you're on to a very, very important area.
I think, you know, technical food, yeah, we probably have to talk a little bit offline exactly what's a technical food. But I think what our surveys of consumers are, they want to know their food is safe. They want to know their food is safe for them and their family, and they're looking for some assurance of that. And so I think all we could do to give people that assurance, it would be a step in the right direction.
Thank you, sir.
Thank you.
I'm going to have to intervene here. And I want to thank, first of all of you for being here this morning. I know Chad has, I think it is refreshing when you get the chairman and the CEO of a $30 billion company to stand up here and be as frank and open and progressive in his thought process and that of his company that you've seen this morning. And I'm sure there are lots of problems yet to be solved. And I think we all seek the solutions that have begun in this country. I find it interesting as I travel North America and the world and talk to CEOs like Chad that every one of them seek to live and work and have their families prosper in a clean environment and country. And so I applaud what you've done. I hope we can do more. And I think the question for all of us is our own accountability and what the changes we can make happen. I'm going to have to stop here because we've out of time, but I do want to thank you for being here. And I think they have a small token of expression of appreciation for you, Chad. Thank you.
Thank you.